Hello and welcome to this episode of Gin and Tonic Tavern Talks. This episode, we're going to discuss the controversial yet appealing idea of co-DMing. So, Megan, what are your thoughts on co-DMing?
Oh boy, that's pretty loaded. On the one hand, you've got someone to half the responsibilities with, because it can be a lot of work to DM. However, you also then don't have as much control as you would if you were the only DM. And I say it like that because no DM has or should have full control of what happens at every stage of the story. If you want to do that, go write a book. Then you've got full control. But you got to let the players help tell the story.
We'll have to do an episode on the roles of a GM, but you're very right. You never have full control, but now you are needing to hand over some of that control. And I can see it being an absolute disaster if you don't talk about your roles ahead of time. However, one thing I would very much so want to avoid is the situations where you're co-GMing, but the co-GM isn't in charge of story. They're essentially just an initiative tracker and a math machine. That sounds pretty dull in my mind. That's an assistant.
Yeah.
You know what? If you need help with initiative, you can tell the players, guess what? You're going to keep track of initiative. Because, some people, the players will know the order of the initiative. By the end of round one, they will know the order of initiative. Will they remember it when it's their turn coming up? Of course not. But they will... But they will know when the bad guys get to go. It's after Dave's turn.
Yes.
A whole other piece on initiative another time. But if you're having trouble with things like that, including monster health, you can assign a player that. I wouldn't drag someone in and say you're the co-GM where you're just going to sit there and be my math machine and not actually play.
I'm not that good at math. I would fail if I had to be just the math.
And it'd be boring because if the main dungeon master is running the combat and you're just the math machine, then you have, unless you are just someone who loves sitting there and doing math for 4 hours with large breaks in between whenever there's role play, which there should be.
Yeah, definitely need breaks.
So neither of us have ever co-GM'd before. I've been GMing for a couple of years. You're running your own campaign right now.
Yeah.
Welcome to the other side of the screen.
I know. I've got, three sessions under my belt? So.
Hey, you ran games for kids before that.
That is true.
Those kept.
I mean, they don't care as much about rules and stuff. So they're just like, okay, let's play. Let's poke stuff.
The rules are more like guidelines.
They are.
Please see our previous podcast about that.
Yeah.
Shameless plug.
Why not? I mean, if they're listening to this, then they're already listening to us. So...
Thank you for that, by the way.
Yes, if you hear our voices in your ears right now, thank you. We appreciate it a lot.
You are all wonderful people. So, Megan and I have decided that we want to try and tackle co-GMing. I don't think we should commit ourselves to a long campaign. And I think the first thing we should do is figure out length. How long are we going to be doing this for? Just in case it is a complete dumpster fire by the end of it still.
Yeah, it definitely could be. I would shoot for 2 to 4 sessions.
I was thinking in the 3 to 4 range, just because I truly believe that our first session co-GMing, no matter how much time and prep we put in, is going to be a little clunky.
Definitely.
So switching from one side to the other might not be as easy, but we'll figure that out. And I'd like to give the players a chance to experience it and get their opinion of co-GMing, because we're both reasonably good game masters.
I mean, you are. I'm still learning.
I think you're doing a fantastic job. Don't sell yourself short.
Why, thank you. I always sell myself short on many, many things.
Oh, so do I. That's why I give compliments as much as I do, because I know people sell themselves short just like my brain does, because my brain hates me.
Same with mine.
So, yeah, I think aiming for 3 to 4 sessions, if it bleeds over and ends up being 5 or 6 just because the players spent 3 hours trying to solve the puzzle that we ran past my 6-year-old.
Yeah.
I often run my puzzles past my 6-year-old and to see if he can logic his way through them, and then love to throw them at a party of adventurers and watch grown adults fall apart trying to solve it. It's great.
Yeah, I imagine that's very fun.
So, you know, if it bleeds over a couple, it bleeds over a couple. But 3 to 4 is probably our golden ticket.
Yeah, I think so.
Then there's, how do we want to split this? Because I don't want anyone to be a math machine.
And then how do we, or like, what kind of story do we want to tell?
Yeah. We're going to have to sit down and write that out. And it's going to have to be something that we can break up into 3 to 4 sessions.
Yeah. I know you enjoy lots of magic, and I do too. Plus, there's always a good, like, dungeon crawl style.
Oh, yeah. You got to throw a couple dungeons in at some point. Yeah. The dungeon doesn't have to be a dungeon. It just has to serve the same purpose. So let's see. Just spitballing some ideas. To borrow from Guy at How to Be a Great Game Master, someone wants something badly by a certain time and is having trouble getting it because of X. For those of you that have never heard of Guy, YouTube, How to Be a Great Game Master, and that man will teach you tons of things.
So, like, there is a small village somewhere and they're being plagued by, I don't know, like rotting zombies or something that seem to be coming out of a cave, but no one who's ever gone into the cave to stop the wherever the zombies are coming from has ever come back. And they need it fixed because they're slowly losing all their townspeople. Go in the cave, find the source of the zombies, and stop them. As a very, very simple premise.
No, that's fine. But now we got to look at it from the other side. So someone in the mine is animating zombies to attack the town.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what do they want in the town? Let's just say, you know what, they want the gem eyes from the golden statue in front of the church.
Oh, that's a lot simpler than I was going to say. I was going to say underneath the church, there's an ancient burial ground that there's some unspeakable treasure down there.
But the statue will, so they want to get the statue.
Mm-hmm.
They're having trouble. Why are they having trouble getting this statue? What's stopping them whenever they come into town?
Maybe there's a town wizard that keeps a barrier up that they stay out.
Or even if there's a town wizard who's able to drive them off,
mm-hmm.
but there's only one town wizard, and the reason he can't go deal with it personally is that if he dies going down there by himself,
everyone's fucked.
The whole village, yeah, everyone's gonna die. So he can't afford to leave the village right now.
Mm-hmm.
This is why he, you know, grabs you, the fools wandering into town going, hey, buddy, here's our quest giver now.
We need help.
We need help. We have a problem. But this also means that if the dungeon is too much for the party, they can always fall back to the town, because the town is a safe place. Kind of leaning in towards the classic D&D, where the dungeon was more than just a one-shot finish.
Mm-hmm. And if all of a sudden they get through the cave super fast by some miracle or extra good rolls, then maybe instead of finding the necromancer or whoever right there in the cave, they have to go through a portal and then through like a maze style deal before they get to it, just to drag it out.
I mean, there's a really neat monster that I've wanted to use. Let me just see if I can pull that up here. Good, the call is still working. Called the Ash Zombie. It has most of the same stats as a regular zombie, but it's got a few twists.
Okay.
So, that's regular zombie, Ash Zombie. Still challenge 1/4. It's out of, okay. Ash Zombie, armor class 8, medium undead, lawful evil, AC 8, 22 hit points, speed of 20 feet, plus one strength, minus 2 dex, plus 3 con, minus 4 intelligence, minus 2 wisdom, minus 3 charisma, bunch of saving throws.
They're about languages, as smart as the mushrooms that I threw at you guys.
Yeah. It's got the undead fortitude, so if the damage reduces it to 0, it makes a constitution saving throw with a DC of +5 plus the damage taken, unless the damage is radiant or critical. On a success, the zombie drops to 1 hit point instead. The Ash Zombie, I mean, and then it's got a slam attack, +3 to hit, one target, does 1d6 plus 1 bludgeoning damage, so average of 4. But the Ash Puff is what I was most interested in. The first time the zombie takes damage, any living creature within 5 feet of the zombie must succeed on a DC 10 constitution saving throw or gain disadvantage on attack roll, saving throws, and ability checks for 1 minute. A creature can repeat the saving throw at the end of each of its turns, ending the effect on it early with a successful save.
Nice. That's very cool.
So what if we change it from the regular zombies to ash zombies, so they're humanoid shaped like burnt corpses.
And maybe they could be coming out of a cave that's in the side of a volcano.
Or you wanted a portal to where this guy is at the end of this dungeon, right?
Right.
Like a big final showdown. So we've got a couple options. We're looking at burnt corpses. So certain layers of Avernus would work for that, assuming we're using Forgotten Realms lore just to keep it easy.
Yeah.
Certain levels of Avernus, the Plane of Fire would also be very good at that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some of the other planes that would be on fire you could use for that. Yeah, no, those would be the two main ones, either something out of the Nine Hells or the Plane of Fire, because I don't think the Abyss has a whole lot of fire in it.
I mean, by its name, it should have a whole lot of nothing.
It's called the Infinite Abyss because it goes on literally forever. Even Demogorgon doesn't know how far down it goes.
That's pretty cool.
It's also continuing to make itself bigger, so there's constantly new levels.
That's even cooler.
Actually, we'll do an entire bit on that, but the Shard of, was it the Shard of Pure Evil? Or the Shard of Elemental Evil? Either way, big long story to that, but anyways, it is constantly burrowing its way down, and lore-wise, Asmodeus, the guy who runs the Nine Hells, has a scepter with a ruby in it, mm-hmm. and the ruby is a chip of this gem, or this shard.
Oh, very cool.
Anyways, that was a random tangent about D&D lore.
It's so very interesting.
Do we want to go with someone in hell, or do we want to go with someone who's just basing themselves out of the plane of fire? Or we could have them on the same plane of existence, but in a volcano, because volcanoes make things cool.
Then there's extra danger to the town. What if it erupts one day and just wipes out the town?
I mean, this guy could be miles away with a portal that they'd have to go through. He could be in a mountain halfway around the world, but he needs that statue because it's the only one of its kind, or it's the last one. Yep, he's collecting all of them so that none of the worshippers of a god. He's trying to wipe out a god by removing all of their statues and just desecrating all of their churches.
That's cool.
Perfect.
I like it.
See, the sentence. Guy invented a wonderful sentence. If you fill out the sentence, you have a story. So now we have a bad guy. We'll figure out who the bad guy is, who has a fortress inside of a volcano that is somewhere. Where exactly that is actually irrelevant. That is opening a portal in a cave system just outside of this town and sending through these ash zombies trying to steal and destroy this church. And between a town cleric and a town wizard, they've been able to kind of hold things at bay, but they're not doing very good otherwise.
I like
I like it. We might think alike.